Couple of months ago, a famous Irish poet died. You may have heard of him. His name was Seamus Heaney. Was an unexpected death. A beloved poet. And it was reported by his son at his funeral that he texted his wife minutes before he died from his hospital bed. And the words that he sent to his wife were in Latin. And they were Noli temere. Do not be afraid. I was deeply touched by this. Do not be afraid. And I thought, what a gift he gave her. Not just English words, don't be afraid, but Latin, which had a kind of, well, biblical significance. It came actually from the Bible. Noli temere. And so it wasn't just a psychological fear that he was addressing in her, but a deep sense of perhaps a terror. And I looked this. Looked this this these words up in the Bible, not something I often do, but I was so moved by these words that I wanted to find out the context. And they come from Matthew, the book of Matthew, and they are the words of Christ. Who, after feeding thousands in the desert with just a few loaves of bread and some fish, he goes up on the mountaintop to pray and sends his disciples home on a boat. And a storm comes up at sea, a terrible raging storm. And threatens the life of the disciples. And they panic. And Christ hears their terror. And he comes down from the mountain and walks across the water on the sea, as Christ is wont to do. And addresses the disciples. They are seeing this vision of Christ approaching, but they only see a ghost because out of this state of fear and panic, they cannot see clearly. And so this vision of Christ appears to them as some kind of specter, as a frightening thing. Because when you're in fear, you see things as terrifying. See out of that perspective. And so Christ says to them, "Take heart. It is I. Do not be afraid." This is the word where these Seamus Heaney's words come from. Take heart. It is I. Do not be afraid. So I can imagine that Heaney's wife had this deep sense of loss, a very surprising loss. And when you have a loss of that depth, your whole world is shaken. Especially if you've had one of those rare things called a successful marriage. And you have lived together for years and years and years, and that person has become part of your identity. And so she must have been shaken to the very depths. Sometimes we say, even when we feel somehow shattered, we say we feel lost and at sea. It's kind of at sea, lost and at sea, like those disciples were in that boat. And so he reminds her, that there is something beyond this small sense of identity that she can take comfort in. And usually, by the way, this phrase, do not be afraid, appears many, many times in the Bible. And it's usually followed by do not be afraid, you are not alone, God loves you, God is with you. And so this deep sense of being a part and being loved by something beyond the human, to take heart, to look into your heart and connect with that divinity, that divine source, as a deep comfort. Last winter, was it? Does this look familiar?
Mm-hmm.
We did some studying of this Heart Sutra under your expert guidance. And one of the things that astounded me in the text of the Heart Sutra was the number of times the Bodhisattva was called fearless. And I actually did a quick count, and 17 times in this short sutra, Buddha refers to the Bodhisattva as the fearless Bodhisattva. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting? Our Heart Sutra, the one emotion that is identified there is the Bodhisattva relies on Prajnaparamita, and the mind is no hindrance. With no hindrance, there is no fear. And so I asked myself, this is really important for Buddha. And it was so moving to Subhuti that he actually cries in this sutra. He said he was so moved by Buddha's teaching that he cried. So I wonder, what is it that is so important about fearlessness on the Bodhisattva path? Why is fear such an obstruction? And so I went back to this feeling of loss of identity, and it seemed to me that the Bodhisattva must lose his or her self in order to serve. And this must be terrifying. And go try to teach somebody this, try to tell someone that they have no self. It takes courage to bring this kind of teaching into the world. In fact, thus having been said, the Buddha told the Venerable Subhuti, "So it is, Subhuti, so it is. Those beings shall be most remarkably blessed, Subhuti, who are not alarmed, not frightened, and not distressed by what is said in this sutra." To speak of being alarmed, being frightened, and being distressed by what is said in a sutra. Obviously, Buddha felt that this is a very alarming state to be in. To have to give up, renounce, relinquish your identity, yourself. And not just that, to relinquish and renounce the self is to become, according to Buddha, an arhan, arhat, an enlightened one. But the Bodhisattva is not merely an arhat. The Bodhisattva not only renounces self, but also renounces Dharma. Doesn't hold on to anything, but turns back into the world, which is the sea, the very dangerous place. This is one of the reasons I suspect that when Buddha resisted going back into the world after his enlightenment, because he didn't think anybody would really understand what he was trying to say, and they would resist it. So in some sense, the person renouncing self has to move beyond that renunciation and renounce the teaching as well. Can't have that comfortable trajectory, sort of going out into some kind of hermitage or monastic life. That's not the path of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva goes, turns around and lets go of that. And with complete fearlessness enters the world. So perhaps in the Christian tradition, the comforting words of Christ are, do not be afraid, God loves you. In our practice, perhaps, do not be afraid, there is no you. Quite a different thing, although not so different in the end. Our typical inclination is to think that in order to address fear, we need to gather ourselves together and fortify the ego, strengthen ourselves, make. And you often hear this. I heard this in my family a lot. Be strong! Be strong. That's not our practice. It's the typical is, be strong. Fight this. Be. Puff up. Meet the world with power. So, Buddha's words on his enlightenment. Seeing but not finding the house builder, I travel through the round of countless births. Oh, painful is birth ever and again. House builder, you have now been seen. You shall not build the house again. Your rafters have been broken down. Your ridgepole is demolished. My mind has now attained the unformed nirvana and reached the end of every kind of craving. And I found it interesting that Buddha refers to the ridgepole and the rafters. He doesn't refer to the foundation. And that interested me. He didn't say the foundation is crumbling. He said the ridgepole and the rafters, which what make the roof, right? No protection. That roof is gone. No protection. You are out there. The house has fallen. Everything you've built up is down. And of course, I'm sure each of you can remember a time in your life when it all fell down. Within a couple of years, I know I quit my job, I lost my house to a highway, my marriage fell apart, my dog died. Just everything was gone. Was terrifying. And feeling very much alone. Lonely. Who am I? My house is gone. You know that story of the three little pigs? Do they have that in Switzerland? The fairy tale, the three little pigs? It's a wonderful little sutra. And the three little pigs go and they build their houses. You have that in Iran?
Yeah, I love that story.
Oh, good.
My mother used to.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, in a way, I'm going to maybe kind of reinterpret the message there. Because the first little pig builds his house out of straw. And the second little pig builds his house out of twigs or boards. And the third little pig, very smart, builds his house out of bricks. Just, wow. And the big bad wolf comes along. You have the big bad wolf? Comes along. Little pig, let me in. Otherwise, I will blow your house down. Huff and I'll puff and I'll blow your house down. And the first little pig says, not by the hair of my chinny chin chin. And sure enough, this wolf, very flimsy house of straw, and just blows it down and gobbles the little pig up, or something to that effect. And the second one, little pig, let me in. Otherwise I'll huff and puff and blow your house down. Not by the hair of my chinny chin chin. Huffed and he puffed. Sure enough, the twig house. But the brick house, I couldn't blow it down. So he came up through the chimney. And the little pig had a nice pot of boiling water at the base of the chimney. Same. Well, in this, nobody ever gets killed because kids don't really like that, but somehow everybody disappears. But the tendency is to interpret this story as advocating building a strong house, building a strong protection. But I think our practice is not to build any house at all. And that's kind of scary. To be, in effect, homeless. This is the Bodhisattva path. What would life be like if we didn't have this, if we didn't walk around like a turtle, you know, with this hard shell, sometimes called armor, ego. What would life be like then if we were unprotected, naked? It would be very frightening, because as soon as we have any sense of fear, wherever it comes from, we are immediately building something to keep it out. So this is the Bodhisattva path to, as perhaps I think the common term in biblical phrase is, what the lion lies down with the lamb. A lion lies down with the lamb. The wolf lies down with the pigs. We dwell fearlessly together in the world. What a novel idea. This is the teaching. And so this is the season of giving. And what a gift is the gift of no fear. And in the Diamond Sutra, Buddha speaks of charity, of giving, and the Bodhisattva gives unconditionally. These gifts of fearlessness. This is the teaching that the Bodhisattva offers. And it's profound. So, coming back to these words that Seamus Heaney offered his wife, do not be afraid. Noli timere. It's the best gift you can give. It's fundamental and liberating.
For the talk, it's very wonderful. And there are 2 points, the no fear and also the no self. And two things came to mind. I don't know if you want to discuss them. One is the not clinging to self and not holding any perception of self. I don't know where that's from. I know Doug mentioned it. Doug gave it to me once. Is that part of the diamond?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, actually there are four no perceptions. No perception of self, no perception of beings, no perception of a life, and no perception of a soul. So there are they're all renunciations of forming ideas or even sense experiences of not just self, but also of others, of the Dharma, and of any kind of immaterial soul, rebirth. And I mean, basically of the self and the Dharma. And I guess the third phase of this sequence of renunciations is the phase of renouncing renunciation. And once you have moved through that, you're Buddha. So it's sort of moving from, and again, this is not a linear process, but the arhan, the Bodhisattva, the Buddha. There's a deeper and deeper realization of true nature, and the you could say the fuel is letting go, relinquishing, renouncing, otherwise known as charity or giving. And we can use a lot of different words. So that was one point. Did you have another?
Oh, the other was even more obvious. somewhere in the teaching, there's a reference to three kinds of giving. One is to give something, a fish. Another is to teach something, like how to fish. The third is not to fear, I think. And I'm not quite sure where that comes from, but it's either from the Bible or from the Dharma someplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know the source of that, but there is a man named Schumacher who wrote a book called Small is Beautiful. And in it, he speaks about the difference between giving a starving man a fish that is a temporary palliative for his distress. And the second is teaching him how to fish, mm-hmm. so that he is empowered and need not be dependent upon others. And the third is not to fear starvation and know that he can take care of himself somehow. So it's probably ultimately a biblical but here we're referring to a fundamental way of being in the world, which is to be free of fear, which leads to the construction of self.
Thank you. Very thought-provoking. Kind of a whimsical note, the story of the three pigs. Maybe the third pig that put up these strong boundaries, built a strong house, he was the one that welcomed the wolf. And he prepared his cauldron to welcome the wolf with. So in a way, he embraced the bad, all this energy, this terribleness. He welcomed it. He prepared for it, and he welcomed it, and he cooked it up. So I thought that might be some other insight into the three pig story.
Yeah, that's a wonderful alternate explanation, or pointing out something about the possibilities involved in that scenario, that there was something, probably something in each of those three pigs that drew the wolf in some form. Hunger.
Bacon.
But, you know, there are layers of meaning here that, all these wonderfully simple children's stories have, sometimes the simpler they are, the richer they are in suggesting possibilities.
So, a question.
Yeah.
So, how do we help others? How do we give others no fear? How do we give others fearlessness?
You're asking me? The trembling one? that's the job of the Bodhisattva, to find, as Buddha spoke of himself as a physician. And so when someone appears in your life who needs this teaching, or needs your comfort, or needs your help, because you are completely open and fearless yourself, you can see clearly what that person needs. And there's no general rule here. That's the real difficulty. It would be wonderful if for every situation we had a rule, like we have the precepts. But as I think many of us discover, here's the precepts hanging up here, and then we have this very specific situation. And how does that precept help us right now with this very complex set of circumstances? It can be terrifying when somebody comes to you with a very, very specific set of problems and conditions, and you are trying to reach for something, a dharma, attached to the dharma, No, you've got to renounce the Dharma and be with that person, that right now, right here. And I know myself, I have been many times confronted. I used to teach philosophy. I started teaching at a very young age. And I was an existentialist. Mm-hmm. And I would talk about, you know, death and dying and the fragility of life. And one day, and I just reveled in being up there in front of the class and just spouting off. One day, one of my students came to my office hour. She was literally shaking and started to cry. And apparently what I had said deeply affected her. And I thought, oh my God, what do I do now? Mm-hmm. You know, I had no idea how to deal with that person and what was going on with her. And so all my theories and all my philosophies, just like, I was completely at a loss. I was at sea. I didn't know what to do. And I there was nothing for me to grasp onto. I mean, I couldn't grasp any longer onto existentialism because that's created the problem. I had to deal with her. So I can't answer that. How do we do it? Like Hemingway said about writing, well, we sit down in front of, at that time it was a typewriter, we sit down in front of the typewriter and open up a vein. That's how we do it. It's the best I can do.
I was talking to a friend a few years ago. He was coming from Iran. He was a student activist and he was in prison for a few months and they've done horrible things to him. So I asked him, weren't you afraid? I mean, being right there in the middle of all of this, and what kept you going? And he said, the fact that I was right, being just, being on the right side of things. I think in the story of Jesus, I think what was behind him saying, do not be afraid, was knowing that he was right, that they were doing the right thing. Mm. I think that helps. Mm. Mm.
That sense of I would perhaps want to expand that experience of rightness. Again, trying to speak from our Zen practice. That there's no explanation for that. There's no, these are the right things. These are the principles. This is the Dharma. I'm reflecting the Dharma in what I'm doing. I don't think it's pretty pretentious to say that Budovitz authorized that, but that in letting go of the Dharma, in letting go of the right as opposed to the wrong, that duality, that rightness is not the rightness of morality. Let's put it that way. It's not the rightness of morality. It's the rightness of this heart. It's and that's why I think in the Christian tradition, love is the encompassing state. So to be in the love of God, to be in that divine place, you know, it feels right. So it's not conceptual, right? It's not intellectual. And I also want to recommend to you this. I've been promoting this YouTube video. This interview with Carl Jung, Face to Face, it's called. And Jung is asked about his early childhood. And did you go to church? Did you believe in God? Oh, sure, of course. You know, this is just what we did. And he was 80, in his early 80s when this interview was taking place. And so the interviewer says, well, what about now? You know, do you believe in God now? And Jung gets this amazing smile and look on his face. And he pauses, rubs his chin and says, I don't believe, I know. Just the way I don't usually tell people to go on to the computer, but you must listen to this interview. Just for that moment when you are witnessing someone who doesn't have to believe because they know deep, deep, deep down. It was so obvious. So this sense of rightness, it couldn't be so weak as to be intellectual to get anybody through something like that. It's not like I'm morally right. That couldn't do it. I just couldn't get you through it. There's got to be something way beyond that. Don't you think? Yeah, Todd?
With Jung, who I've read of him, there he said we were born with five affects, cousin, which I wrote were sadness, comes with the package, in other words, contempt, anger, joy and interest, and fear. So where I'm at right now, I think one of the most wonderful things that happened to me that brought me here was fear, and what's happened through Zazen and therapy is managing fear in very deep ways. I don't, at this point, I don't think that you can get rid of fear. I think fear comes from very primal parts. Mysteriously, everything's eating itself. I mean, I've seen it in animals. It's in all animals. They're afraid of being eaten. I think that's about all I really need to say on it.
Thank you. So, you're referring to a form of fear which is kind of critical to survival. And fear...
Not just physical survival.
Mm-hmm.
A lawyer says to me, five words, and he just disappears. And I genuflect in front of him because of just what he says, because of how I put him socially, a lot of ways in which it seems like fear dissipates temporarily, but it doesn't seem like it somehow just evaporates and through. I think that it becomes more and more perhaps manageable, but it seems very inherent, if I will say that, to life.
I'm not sure that the that the fearlessness of bodhisattvas is a condition which never experiences fear. So fearlessness may not mean that fear never arises. It may mean that fear can be transformed.
And I think, Doug, you asked the question, I think, that you're talking about. Anyway, I'll speak to you. It seems to me that in our practice, there's no such situation. There is no such situation as one being who has no fear and another being who is totally afraid. It's one being. So if someone comes to you and that person has a problem or is afraid, it's your problem. And you have to take care of yourself with your problem.
Simultaneously while you're meeting that person.
Yeah.
That's tough. It takes practice. It takes some skill. But you can do it. Can you do it?
Yeah.
Well, this is Buddha's admonition about not creating perception of self, of other, of life, of soul. So there's no perception of other. There's no perception of self. This is what is often referred to as codependent arising, or no separation. No separation. So once you can actually experience that no separation, in a sense, fear dissolves, because fear is a function of separation. That's why often when people are frightened, I know when I'm frightened, sometimes I just want somebody to be there. I just want to hold somebody's hand. I just want someone to hug me. I don't want them to come. I don't want all that verbiage. I just want to know I'm not separate, I'm connected. And sometimes that physical connection is what we need.
Yes, if you're speaking in terms of being fearless and concerned about some fearful person coming to you, forget that problem. That's not a problem. The problem is you and your own fear.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the wolf coming to your door. There's no wolf. There's no you. Did you want to say something?
No, I sent you through your sentence.
The subject came up in Canon Do, and one really wonderful speaker, practitioner, I guess, said to Les, he said, "What is fear?" And, Les is. And I think he said, because my hearing isn't so good, sometimes works out well, but. I think he said, that you're going to lose something.
Say that again?
That he thought to answer this young man, or this man, his question was, he thought that fear is to lose, that you're going to lose something.
To lose something. Mm-hmm.
Or to gain.
much or to gain something.
Or to gain something, of course. Thank you. I've been listening to a talk, Cliff, that you gave me on a CD. This comes out of Shambhala. This Pema, Prema, Chandra?
Pema Chandra.
Sounds good.
Sounds close.
She speaks about this from her teacher, whatever.
Trungpa Rinpoche.
And because she went to him with so many troubles, and the message that I'm getting from this is that it's not you have to turn toward it. I mean, it's an inside job, and when you look at it, it isn't particularly attractive, because she calls it, or he called it, a shaky tenderness, the one with the fear. So it's a little wobbly if you're in that situation. And she draws upon mindfulness practice as a way to manage it, or deal with it, or live with it, or accept it. Also drawing upon what may be fear of death, fear of embarrassment, fear of feeling inadequate. These so many things are like this. And she speaks about a private talk she had with him, wherein he said, it's like you're standing at the ocean, and a wave comes and knocks you down, and you're tumbling in the water, and your eyes are burning, you've got water going through your nose and your mouth, you're struggling for breath. You get up, and you get knocked down again and again, over and over and over. And she said that he did give her some comfort in that there may be a time that the waves may not be so powerful, or there may be no waves,
or you may discover there's no you to be hit. And that's, I think that's the fundamental teaching of our practice, that that this discovery, this is the fundamental teaching, that there's no duality between you and the waves, and the pig and the wolf, the lion and the lamb. And this is the fundamental discovery. There's no you there to be victimized. I mean, yeah, clearly this drive to, what do they call it, fight or flight. Something's coming at you, and it threatens your existence. I think perhaps fundamentally it would be threatening your identity, who you are, your reality, your very being. And so the immediate reflex is to either fight it or run. And these are acts of which presuppose that there's something to defend, there's something to protect, and there's something to needs safety, or there's something that needs to fight it and to get stronger. So that fight and flight reaction comes to be seen as it's a samsara. It will just go on and on and on. You'll be in that constant state of duality with the things that are coming at you, those waves. So you can do that forever. You can fight it, and you can run and fight and run and fight and run. That's samsara, as far as I can see. But to turn toward it, to turn into it, and to discover there's no self here. And that is, it's scary. As you just sort of stand there and just be in the midst of it. I just sort of wonder what would happen, you know, just metaphorically, if the three pigs were just walking around without any houses. Because I see I'm walking in these woods and I see the turkeys and the deer and the cats, and they're just like walking around. Somehow when I enter the scene, everything flees. I try, you know, but somehow, I don't know, they must sense that there's something about the human presence that I'm really not part of the scene. But if we could all just take our place in this vast realm of being, we wouldn't have to build these